From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Ron DeSantis has signed the budget for the new fiscal year that started this week. He also has exercised his line item veto power.
Some of the stuff wasn't necessarily bad. It's just I set a target to be underneath current year budget.
Also this week, more than 100 new laws went into effect at the start of July, including one to protect residents from footing the bill for AI data centers' energy needs.
We've seen in other states, particularly in Virginia, where a lot of their ratepayers have seen a dramatic increase because they did not have the necessary safeguards.
And we'll get an update on sargassum, the smelly brown seaweed that's washing up on Florida's shores. I'm Regan McCarthy, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of the top stories from Tallahassee. Projects to expand nursing education, protect Wakulla Springs, and invest in cancer research are among the items Governor Ron DeSantis cut from the budget when he used his line item veto power on the new spending plan that took effect this week. WFSU's Ronnie Graham has more.
After months of conflict among Florida's top Republicans, Governor Ron DeSantis signed Florida's new spending plan just days before the start of the new fiscal year. DeSantis used his line item veto power to cut about $1.6 billion in spending, including $810 million in member projects across the state. DeSantis says many of the projects were nice to have, but he says he's committed to tamping down on state spending.
Some of the stuff wasn't necessarily bad. It's just I set a target to be underneath current year budget, so we had to get to that level, and some of the things were plausible, but you just have to make decisions.
After the cuts, the new budget comes in at about $117 billion. That's just a couple billion more than last year's budget. DeSantis says the state is spending less in his tenure when adjusted for inflation.
If you just kept spending constant from where we were 4 years ago and just based on inflation, that would have put us to $132.5 billion. So we are not only spending less in nominal terms, which we are, but really far less in terms of inflation adjusted.
In Tallahassee, DeSantis cut spending in higher education and scientific research at Florida State University and the FAMU FSU College of Engineering. FSU lost $2.5 million that would have expanded its College of Nursing. The FAMU FSU College of Engineering lost $2 million in funding for projects, including money to study how cancer drugs perform in microgravity. DeSantis also vetoed an $850,000 ask for Wakulla Springs remediation research. I'm Ronnie Graham.
More than 140 laws passed during this year's legislative session took effect Wednesday at the start of the new fiscal year. WFSU's Tristan Wood runs through several of the bills that are impacting Floridians.
One of the most talked about bills passed during the legislative session was the AI data centers bill. It gives local governments control over the placement of artificial intelligence data centers through comprehensive planning and land development regulations. It also puts guardrails in place when it comes to the center's water and energy use, including ensuring that companies behind the centers foot the bill for any new energy infrastructure needs. Hialeah Gardens Republican Senator Brian Avila sponsored the measure. He says the new law is meant to address many of the concerns Floridians have expressed after seeing the impacts of AI data centers around the country.
We've seen in other states, particularly in Virginia, where a lot of their ratepayers have seen a dramatic increase because they did not have the necessary safeguards for their residents and their ratepayers.
Some counties are already looking to use the bill. Wakulla and Jackson counties have already passed a ban on data centers, and others are considering moratoriums. Jackson County resident Elijah Simmons says he's glad to see the communities taking action, but he'd like to see broader protections.
So I think Jackson County leading the charge, both the people and our commissioners signing this ban, it's inspirational for the counties all around to kind of, you know, do a similar thing. Because if they do it in Walton, it's still going to affect us here in Jackson. If they do it in Holmes, it'll still affect us here in Jackson, and vice versa.
Another bill that is taking effect allows the state to label certain groups domestic terrorist organizations, opening the door to criminal penalties for members and expulsion for college students who promote them. The legislation allows the state to freeze funding and penalize people who support groups Florida lists as domestic terrorist organizations. Students who support the groups on college campuses could be expelled, and those attending on a visa could be reported to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. The new law has faced opposition from some Muslim groups that say they are concerned they will be targeted. CARE Florida's Chelsea Madrigas says after the measure passed that she thinks the law targets Muslims and is a threat to all states' residents' First Amendment rights.
Governor DeSantis has effectively authorized the construction of police state infrastructure designed to bypass the judiciary and silence the voices of Florida's minority communities and political dissenters.
With it taking effect, the head of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement can start making recommendations of groups put on the list. And finally, a wide-ranging farm bill is taking effect. One of the most discussed parts of the bill bans cities and counties from outlawing gas-powered equipment, like leaf blowers and lawn mowers. The law also creates density limits for developers looking to build in more than 100 small municipalities. It limits development in those cities to one unit per 20 acres, unless there is a unanimous vote from local governments to waive the density cap. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida's gubernatorial candidates have been crisscrossing the panhandle in a bid to make their case to prospective voters. The Rural News Service has been catching up with some of them to hear their vision for Florida's future. Randy Vexta tells us why they're here and what residents have to look forward to in this year's election.
When heading to the polls this November, residents all over Florida will have to select a new governor. But before that can happen, the number of candidates has to be whittled down in the August primary. Democrat David Jolly says he's been hearing from people in rural counties that they want politicians to take their concerns seriously.
Rural Florida is just asking to make sure that they have a seat at the table, that their voice is heard as well, because too many of our politics often get decided in the urban corridors.
This issue is bipartisan, as Republican candidates Paul Renner and James Fishback echoed similar sentiments.
One size does not fit all. Rural communities have unique needs. They have unique demands.
More than a third of Florida's counties don't generate enough revenue to support local government services like public safety, schools, and roads, which means the state has to pick up the tab. And not all of the needs of fiscally constrained counties get funded. Many of them, as Fishback notes, are within North Florida's panhandle.
Florida is more than Miami, Orlando, and Jacksonville. It is rural counties like Bay, rural counties like Liberty, Gulf, and Franklin.
Rural communities are entering campaign season with many issues and concerns, from legislation on data centers to worries about the affordability of homes and even the resolution of a state constitution amendment proposal that would significantly reduce local government revenues. Niceville resident Randy Wise recently attended a rally for Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, who is also seeking to upgrade his job. Wise says he's grateful for the time the candidates are spending in North Florida.
We want to know the guy at the top and feel like we could, quote unquote, call him if we need to. We want to be able to reach out and touch him and know that he feels our pain up here with the issues that we're experiencing.
Wise works in real estate, and he's concerned that the number of new arrivals to the area are driving up demand and home prices in a way that makes it harder for some longtime residents to keep their existing properties.
We're just glad we're being recognized up here in the Panhandle, and we've got those guys coming through and talking to us. You hit the nail on the head. We feel like sometimes we're a little bit sidelined because we're not Miami or Fort Lauderdale.
Democrat David Jolly is now considered the party's frontrunner for governor after Orlando Mayor Jerry Demings dropped out due to health concerns. On the Republican side, Congressman Byron Donalds leads his field and has also made stops in the panhandle, including Mariana. In a statement, a spokesperson for Donalds says people are telling him, quote, they just want Florida to remain Florida. I'm Randy Vuxta in Panama City.
Students in Florida colleges or GED programs must be U.S. citizens or, quote, lawfully present under new rules approved by the Florida State Board of Education this week. Central Florida Public Media's Joe Mario Pedersen tells us the new rules don't explain what lawfully present means.
The new rules apply to Florida's 28 state colleges and the adult education program. The rules don't affect state universities. At the board meeting, nearly 40 members of the public spoke against the citizenship requirements. They also expressed concern about what lawfully present means and whether it would affect students in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. Orlando Democratic State Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith says Florida law requires the board to maintain an open-door admission policy at state colleges.
Our Constitution also requires you to provide for the education of all children within our borders, which makes what you are doing unconstitutional for those dually enrolled minors in the Florida college system classes.
The rules could take effect 20 days after being filed with the Florida Department of State. Joe Mario Pedersen in Orlando.
The State Board of Education did not respond to questions about whether the rules would affect DACA recipients. And a new political action committee has formed to campaign against the property tax referendum on November's ballot. WUSF's Steve Newborn talks with the organizer about what they're trying to accomplish.
Brian Deloge is a former Leon County commissioner who started Vote No on 3. The PAC is incorporated in Tampa. He says the tax reductions would end up shifting higher costs to renters and small businesses that don't have homestead exemptions.
You have to have courts. You have to have roads. Now, we can change how often we repair the roads or we mow the medians, and all of that will happen under this scenario.
Deloge says they'll advise local officials and groups how they can get the word out ahead of the referendum. It would raise the standard homestead exemption for non-school property taxes to $250,000 by 2028. It would have to be passed by at least 60% of voters to take effect. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
And if you're a teacher, speaking your mind on social media can have consequences. But some have fought back and won. WUSF's Carrie Sheridan reports on a Sarasota teacher who found himself at the center of a firestorm over free speech and what he learned.
Derek Rich is a social studies teacher at Sarasota High. In January, shortly after Renee Good was shot dead in Minnesota by ICE agents, he posted about it on his personal social media. He used the F word and basically said ICE would face justice someday. Someone took a screenshot and put it on Facebook, calling him an unhinged teacher. The district investigated. Rich stood his ground.
The First Amendment is there for a reason. And I don't care if you're a teacher or you're a public employee anywhere in the state of Florida, you have the right as an American to speak your mind.
Courts in Florida last year heard a case about a public school math teacher in Duval County. He had reposted disparaging memes about Bernie Sanders in 2020. The teacher's name was Tom Caggiano. He was punished. Then a court of appeal found in his favor because it involved a matter of public concern, the presidential election, and the school board failed to show its work was disrupted by those posts. Rich says more teachers should know this.
My fellow educators need to know that the Caggiano decision protects you. You know, the era of modern day McCarthyism that's been directed towards teachers in Florida, it's over.
A Sarasota district spokesman said he won't comment on personnel matters. Documents show the district walked back the letter of discipline it initially sent Rich, but still warned of progressive discipline if something like it happens again. I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
This past weekend, the Republican Party of Florida brought candidates, elected officials, and activists to the Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood for its Sunshine State Showdown. It's a major gathering ahead of this fall's midterm elections. The event also featured debates in two congressional races. WLRN's Carlton Gillespie spoke with PolitiFact's Samantha Putterman, who attended the event and fact-checked several claims made by candidates and speakers.
Can you briefly tell us what this Sunshine Showdown was? This wasn't exactly a debate between gubernatorial candidates, right?
Right. It was really a forum-style meeting, you know, of top Republican leaders in the state to really discuss their priorities for the midterms, some of what they've done in the past in the state. There were two congressional debates in districts 25 and 19, but there was no debate, you know, between the GOP governor candidates.
And of those GOP governor candidates, U.S. Representative Byron Donalds is the clear frontrunner, which made him the frequent target of attacks at this event. Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins went after his voting record, saying Donalds voted, quote, against three pay raises for military service members, including the largest pay raise for the military in 22 years. What did you find out about that claim?
Yeah, so Collins cherry-picked some of Donald's votes against, you know, large defense spending packages that authorize military pay raises, kind of ignoring that Donald's, you know, voted for other measures that did include those raises. So we previously rated a similar claim by Collins mostly false. but it has to do with the annual National Defense Authorization Act, and that's a sweeping, you know, package that sets funding and policy for the entire Defense Department. And it does include military pay increases, but it's also, you know, thousands of pages long and authorizes billions in funding for a slew of military operations with a lot of unrelated provisions that are often tacked on. So Donald's, you know, he did vote against the legislation in 2022, 23, and 2025. But he said that was because, you know, he disagreed with certain provisions in those bills. There was funding for Ukraine, certain climate initiatives. But he supported the package, which also had military pay raises in 2021 and 2024. So it's just, you know, you have to look at the full scope of it.
Well, since we're talking about an upcoming election, let's talk about some of the election-related claims that were made by speakers at this event. U.S. Rep. Kat Kamak, who represents the area of Northern Florida, said, quote, "You should have to show an ID and you should have to be a citizen in order to vote." But that's already the case, isn't it?
Yeah. So Congress banned non-citizen voting in federal elections. It was in 1996. And while, you know, those things can still happen, cases of non-citizen voting, it's extremely rare. And states are the ones that set laws on voter ID, which, as we know, Florida recently did with its version of the SAVE Act. And that new law, which starts January 1st, 2027, that will require voters to provide photo identification, you know, such as an active U.S. passport or a state driver's license at the polls before being allowed to vote. And it also prohibits, you know, the use of student IDs and retirement center IDs, which used to be acceptable forms of identification. And it also will require, you know, that newly issued Florida driver's license after that date and state issued IDs that they indicate people's citizenship status. So this is very similar to that stalled Save America Act that's backed by President Trump.
On the election note, Senator Rick Scott compared the vote counting in Colombia's recent election to the vote counting in California's primary elections. Why isn't that quite an apples to apples comparison?
Yeah. So Colombia's election, right, was administered nationally with just two candidates on the ballot. And the country doesn't also have any mail-in voting. And California's June 2nd primary, which some race results, you know, have taken days or weeks, they included several contests. Counties also administered those elections, and most California voters cast ballots by mail, which requires, you know, more time to process and verify.
And what of James Fishback? The Republican gubernatorial candidate was invited and then very notably disinvited from the event after a series of controversial statements, including calling Representative Donalds, who is Black, a slave. Did he get any mention from the candidates?
Not really. I didn't really hear anyone refer to him by name very often, if at all. But there were some remarks, you know, about not giving anti-Semitic, quote unquote, candidates a platform in reference to some of Fishback's remarks. There was, I think, in one of the congressional debates, they asked candidates if they would denounce these sort of remarks in reference to Fishback, of which they all agreed. But he wasn't a major figure in the day.
That was WLRN's Carlton Gillespie speaking with PolitiFact's Samantha Putterman about this past weekend's Sunshine State Showdown, hosted by the Florida GOP. Florida has a new transportation law that changes how new vehicle brands can be sold in the state. The bill didn't make any headlines when it passed or when Governor Ron DeSantis signed it in April. It takes effect later this year. WUSF's Douglas Soule talked to independent journalist Jason Garcia with the newsletter Seeking Rents. Garcia reported on how donations and lobbying are behind a new requirement for car dealers and why it matters.
So what's the story here?
There was this really unusual provision tacked into a otherwise seemingly mundane transportation bill. And it, you know, boiling it all the way down, it essentially is a new law that is going to require car companies. I'm glossing over some details, but it's going to generally require car companies that want to sell new brands in Florida to use multiple car dealerships, multiple middlemen car dealers, if they want to bring that car to Florida. They're going to have to use at least three. And what was sort of interesting about that is it turns out this is an idea that was lobbied through the legislature by one car dealer in particular, Brahman Management, which is the Miami-based company founded by the billionaire Republican mega donor Norman Brahman. And from the records we were able to get out of the legislature, it seems as if Brahman Management was upset about a potential deal with a car company in Spain, Cupra. It wants to come to the U.S., and it has been talking about a potential exclusive distribution deal with Penske Automotive Group. And of course, Florida and most other U.S. states have these ridiculously arcane laws that, like, you and I can't just buy a car from any car manufacturer that we want. We have to go through these middleman dealers for most cars. So to comply with that, Cupra has been in talks to distribute exclusively through Penske, and Brahmin management apparently did not like that, so got the legislature to essentially pass a law that makes that impossible.
You use public records to get info. What exactly did you find?
Car dealers generally, and Brahmin specifically, are some of the biggest donors in all of Florida politics. We got emails showing that a lobbyist for Brahmin management gave this original legislation to the legislature. Specifically, this lobbyist emailed the language to a guy by the name of Representative Mike Redondo, a Republican from Miami. That very same week, Brahmin companies donated $20,000 to Mike Redondo. So we had a $15,000 donation the day before they provided the language that came in through a political committee that Representative Redondo controls, and then $5,000 in bundled hard dollar contributions to his regular campaign account that followed a few days after he had taken the legislation, which he submitted into drafting, which is basically the process that a legislator has to do that in order to get the ball rolling on a piece of legislation. But it didn't stop there. So I'll just give you one other particularly eye-popping example. This idea was eventually filed as standalone legislation before it got slipped into this transportation package at the very end. The Senate sponsor of this bill was a guy by the name of Jay Trumbull, a state senator. He's a Republican from the Panama City area. That same month, November 2025, so just before the 2026 session began, Brahmin gave $50,000 to Jay Trumbull via a fundraising committee he controls.
Now, why does all this matter? Why should Floridians care?
One is sort of the specific issue of the way we still have these antiquated laws controlling and limiting people's ability to buy cars from wherever they want to buy them. You know, this would be like Florida having laws on the books that say you can't buy a Mac directly from Apple. You can only buy it through Target or Walmart or Best Buy, right? That's an absurd proposition, and yet it is exactly how Florida and so many other states still treat car sales specifically. People should be allowed, if in a truly free market state, and we've got a lot of legislators in Florida that love to tell us how much they love the free market, we wouldn't have these government mandated middlemen that you have to buy through for almost all new cars. So I think it shows how this is a system that exists solely because of the entrenched lobby preserves it that way, and that the interests being represented when they change dealership laws are the dealers themselves.
Jason, it was nice talking with you.
Yeah, good to see you.
That was independent journalist Jason Garcia with the newsletter Seeking Rents. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, some Florida beaches are being overwhelmed with millions of tons of smelly brown seaweed called sargassum. A record amount has washed ashore near Miami, the Keys, and Northwest Florida. WGCU's Southwest Florida in Focus host Jennifer Crawford is joined by Leslie Hudson from the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network to learn where sargassum could hit next.
Tell our audience what exactly sargassum is.
Depending on who you are and where you live in the state of Florida, sargassum is either beneficial or a nuisance, and most people find it a nuisance. It's a large belt of microscopic matter that floats in the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and it floats generally towards the United States in the summer months. Now, it can vary from year to year. Some years it can be not as bad as others. The last several years, we've kind of been in this uptick where the sargassum has been very prevalent. And this year, researchers are saying that the sargassum belt that we usually starts down by Mexico and floats northward towards the U.S. is probably going to be one of the worst belts of sargassum we've seen in several years. So they're calling it a potential record-breaking year in terms of how that will impact the United States. And we've already seen large flotillas of the sargassum come to the shores of the United States, in Florida in particular. We've had already several bouts of it this summer and anticipating that to increase as we get into the summer months. And as it floats northward, NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, has a website where you can actually track those belts live and see where they are. You also can check in with your lifeguards at your beaches if you do not want to swim in it. A lot of people do not. They don't find it favorable. So you can check ahead. But we are anticipating this to be one of the worst in recent years with the impacts here.
What is the latest movement of this entire sargassum drift?
It's very prevalent right now in the Florida Keys. Ironically, over Memorial Day weekend, most of the coast of Florida did okay. There was a lot of people at the beaches trying to cool off and trying to get into the ocean. But just 5 days after Memorial Day, we had an influx of sargassum all across the state of Florida, in particular the southeast side and the southwest side of the state, because we're a peninsula and these are large belts of sargassum that float northward. Currently, we're seeing a big influx of that sargassum in the Florida Keys. They usually get it pretty much consistently throughout the summer months. It varies on how thick it is, how much it extends across the Gulf side and the Atlantic side.
Is it possible to forecast where the majority is headed?
It's variant on those wind directions, so it drifts just on the currents. There is no live animals that are moving these belts. So if the winds are predominantly shifting west or a northwest component, that's going to push some of those belts that have been plaguing areas like parts of South America and into Mexico, where there's been just huge, huge thick belts of these sargassum carpets. And those eventually move northward. And once you get into the Gulf, there is no other place for it to go other than the Gulf Coast states. So that's why we get these influxes. The influx started in May in those countries and has pushed northward. Currently, there are a lot of belts that are impacting the Caribbean islands that could impact summer plans down to the Caribbean, some that's impacting parts of Jamaica as well. But there's not one massive belt that's coming to the United States. There's just little clusters, but these are several hundred yards long. They're very large, but there's not one massive mile-wide belt that's coming to the U.S. They're clusters that break up with the ocean currents. So it's dependent on the winds and those ocean currents that will push everything eventually towards the U.S. into the summer.
Does it have any impact on the health of humans or pets that are on the beach?
It's not necessarily dangerous if you interact in the water. It does have harmful effects if it's left in the water. There's multiple things that can happen. It absorbs some of the oxygen that's around it. Oftentimes, if there's a big carpet of sargassum that gets stalled in a particular body of water, it can create a fish kill because the oxygen around it is absorbed into that belt. So it can have a very detrimental effect on marine life. When it's in the water, it can actually serve as a benefit for baby sea turtles. They will actually ride in the currents in those sargassum belts, which is a huge benefit for the sea turtle population. A lot of folks get up in arms about sargassum when you say it's not good for any particular area. It has its benefits offshore when it's floating through the Atlantic or the Caribbean, as long as it's not impacting the oxygen levels. It's when it gets closer to land and it actually makes landfall that it becomes more of a concern.
Do you have any idea why we are seeing this record number of sargassum fields? Why is it so bad this year?
It's very hard to pinpoint it to one specific thing. It's kind of like hurricane season. We go through cycles. In hurricane season, we can go into a decadal cycle where we have 10 years or so where it's very busy. Sargassum is similar to that. So there'll be a cycle where there's been an influx. We are currently in an increased cycle. Last year was also a very bad year in terms of sargassum impacting the United States and Florida. We're in that pattern where more of it is coming off of the currents down by South America, down by Mexico, and pulling into the U.S. because you get landlocked once those belts get into the Gulf. But a lot of it is coming from South America, and we're seeing just a bigger influx these last several years.
That was Southwest Florida in Focus host Jennifer Crawford speaking with Florida Public Radio meteorologist Leslie Hudson. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Tristan Wood, Randy Vuxta, and Ronnie Graham. Thanks also to Carlton Gillespie, Douglas Soul, and Jennifer Crawford. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox. I'm Regan McCarthy. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.